live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome you to this program, video streaming and broadcasting live from our studios in New York City. Today, in our guest segment, in about 30 minutes, we'll be joined by Professor Lucia Tomjanovic. She is the postdoctoral fellow, PhD in biochemistry from the Comparative Genomics Center at James Cook University in Australia. She is also a neurodynamics researcher, University of British Columbia. She is the associate editor of the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease and the author of many published peer-reviewed papers. What we're doing is inviting her back. She was here 2 weeks ago talking about, do vaccines really give us immunity? And she said, no. Now, she and 47 other scientists and physicians, I was filming for a new major documentary on vaccines. I did not have a chance to talk with her about the myths and flaws in vaccine herd immunity theory. And that's why you're being encouraged by your physician and the U.S. Public Health Service to get your vaccines. I will be sharing with her and you Dr. Russell Blaylock, a medical doctor's article on herd immunity, the deadly impossibility of herd immunity through vaccination. Also, I just reviewed today a 45-page scientific study on herd immunity, and it also shows, as a part of it, a 30-year secret official transcript that the government has been covering up vaccine hazards just to sell us more vaccine, and it ends up harming our children. But it also addresses herd mentality. Now, mind you, one of the pillars upon which the entire vaccine program exists is herd immunity. We will challenge the official scientific rationale by one of the top immunologists, researchers in the world on today's show. The latest on health and nutrition, including what you can expect from green tea and chocolate compounds, two separate articles, what happens when your kid becomes a couch potato. I've mentioned that for years now in the New York City Marathon, the Natural Living and Running Walking Club, we take in a combination of powders with coconut water. Well, there's some new insights on coconut water. Also, instead of drinking wine, why not have a berry juice? Well, someone's come up with a berry wine, and it's good for diabetes. Also, you wonder why so many kids are obese? It is because we're feeding them the wrong food in the wrong amount, dead disease food, but it's also because of the overuse of antibiotics. Why do we give so many kids antibiotics? Well, because of vaccines causing inflammation and inner ear infections. And how is that exactly connected to being overweight? I'll share that with you. So we have a lot on health and nutrition, always from peer-reviewed literature, always something that you can rely upon. Then I will give you the latest on why I'm concerned that our federal government and its different mammoth bureaucracies are out of touch with the real needs of our society. And yet, both sides of the corporate political spectrum, which controls 95% of the American media, are explaining to us that they have answers, and I don't see it. What I do see is the feds are cutting Social Security benefits from retirees who couldn't pay back student loans. Are you aware of that? Are you aware that there are currently millions of American students who did not have the background financially to pay their own way through college, so they got a father, a mother, maybe even a grandparent, to sign on the bottom line for them? Now the young person is out of college, has no job, so who do they go after? The person who signed. What if that's a person just living on Social Security and has no other means of support? Too bad. you know, one of those real caring bureaucracies that people love to spend money on that gives us nothing in return? Well, they know where to get the money. Just deduct it from the Social Security checks. Didn't know about that? I'll give you more on that. Also today from the environment, we can thank the U.S. courts for throwing out the EPA coal pollution rule. What does that mean? It means that 240 million Americans will now lose protections against danger, smog, and soot pollution following yesterday's court decision. That means that there will be 34,000 Americans dying this year because of exposure to these very dangerous emissions. But it also means 15,000 heart attacks will not be prevented. 400,000 cases of asthma attacks will not be prevented, and it will increase to $280 billion medical cost. Also from environmental section today, if time permits, many of you from KPFK, our sister station, knows that we are waging a grassroots campaign to get as many people out to vote yes in November. We want all genetically engineered food to be labeled as such. The latest is DuPont, Monsanto are spending tens of millions of dollars to defeat that California genetically engineered food labeling initiative. So they have on their side, Proposition 37, they have unlimited amounts of money and PR firms, and we don't. But Jeffrey Smith, one of the leaders of this movement, is out there and drumming up support, and within the next 3 weeks, I'll be releasing every day a different segment of a documentary that will address every single concern you have about genetically modified organisms, because we don't have the time to run up and down the state showing the film, the new documentary, in theaters. Instead, we're going to do our whole campaign over the internet. Short segments, very well done, all the information. So let's see how Monsanto and DuPont do when they're up against empowered, positive people, populace, who say, yes, we're going to work together. So I'm looking forward to everyone working together to defeat Monsanto and DuPont and the people behind them. As you see, we have a lot to share. And today, I'll be time permitting. No, I'm going to make the time. I'm going to give you the next installment on our Understanding Human Nature series. Let's begin. I believe that we should be consuming somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 4 ounces of organic dark chocolate each day without all the preservatives or processed sugars. And now there are hundreds of varieties to select from. I also believe we should be taking green tea, or white tea, or oolong tea, or red tea, anywhere from 250 to 1,000 milligrams a day under normal conditions. Now, if you have cancer, if you have age-related conditions, that might go up really high. But for most people, what I just mentioned is adequate throughout the day, and you can get it decaffeinated. Here's the latest on this. This is from the Journal of Neurovirology, and this is what it says. The article is entitled, Catechins Protect Neurons Against Mitochondrial Toxins and HIV Proteins Via Activation of BDNF Pathway, end quote. Now, break it into lay language. Here's what it really says. The current protocols for AIDS-defining illnesses and HIV drug therapies simply don't work. They're not able to control the virus complete replication in the brain and are therefore ineffective against complications like neurocognitive impairment in the patients. However, this new study published online in the Journal of Neurovirology has revealed that a group of plant polyphenols known as catechins, cat, C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N-S, catechins, that occur naturally in green tea and coca tree pods, which is chocolate, can help prevent these neurological complications. Now, earlier studies have shown that the protein brain derivative, neurotrophic factor, P, plays a vital role in supporting the survival and growth of neurons, those are your brain cells, within the brain, and that it is active in brain areas linked to learning and higher thinking and memory. And it was discovered that AIDS-defining patients have lower levels of this in their brains than healthy individuals, which indicates this could be directly responsible for cognitive impairment. So John Hopkins University study team, led by Joseph Steiner, assessed the impact on brain cells of different substances, and this is what they found. So in lay language, the bottom line is, if you're a person who is suffering from cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, ALS, dementia, memory loss, or specifically AIDS-related conditions with neurological problems, then make sure you get your chocolate or your green tea throughout the day, every day. Now, adding one more scientific article from as reported in Science Daily, and this was done at the University of Glasgow, and it was published in Nanomedicine, the peer-reviewed journal. Here's what it says. Green tea shows promise in tackling cancer. Quote, the extract, known as EPCG, galate, has been known to have preventative anti-cancer properties, but fails to reach tumors when delivered by conventional intravenous administration. However, in laboratory tests, University of Glasgow, researchers used an approach that allowed the treatment to be delivered specifically to tumors after intravenous administration. Nearly two-thirds of the tumors it was delivered to either shrank or disappeared within 1 month, and the treatment displayed no side effects to normal tissues. The tests are thought to be the first time that this type of treatment has made cancer's tumors shrink or vanish. In the test on two different types of skin cancer, 40% of both types of tumor vanished, and that's substantial. My thoughts on this are that if they use the green tea in purified form and used it with glutathione, vitamin A, and vitamin C intravenous, they would even get greater impact and greater effect. Now, if your kid is a couch potato, not good. If you're a couch potato, not good, and you don't have to lay on a couch, be a sedentary, you can sit at a computer all day or a desk. Here is the latest from the University of Michigan's Mott Children's Hospital National Poll, and it says the following. Couch potato kids are the biggest child health problem in the U.S. Adults across the U.S. rate not getting enough exercise as the top health concern of children this year. I would say that that is equal to the amount of dead and denatured, high-calorie, low-nutrient, high-caloric density foods they're consuming. Every time they have a soft drink with the fructose, every time they have sucrose, glucose, caffeine, and the coffee and caffeinated beverages, the hamburgers, the french fries, the super shakes, then you compound that with not exercising, you have a kid that is going to absolutely positively end up sick as an adult and more likely as a teenager. Glad to see this article. This is from the American Chemical Society just this week. Here's what it says, as reported in Science Daily. Coconut water really does deserve its popular reputation as Mother Nature's own sports drink, according to new scientific analysis of the natural beverage. And this is what it concluded at the national meeting of the American Chemical Society. And so if you engage in exercise, then coconut water has 5 times, that's 500% more potassium than Gatorade or Powerade. And whenever you get cramps in your muscles, potassium will help you get rid of the cramps. It is a healthy drink that replenishes the nutrients that your body has lost during moderate workout, end quote. Good. And two other things. This is about making a berry wine. And I'll quote this. This is from Mainstream Science, Journal of Food Science. Here's what it says. In evaluating the bioactive compounds in Illinois blueberry and blackberry wines, University of Illinois scientists have found compounds that inhibit enzymes responsible for carbohydrate absorption assimilation, and that could mean a tasty way to help people with diabetes decrease their blood sugar. Quote, we're thinking about the dealcoholized fermented fruit beverage that would optimize the inhibition of the alpha amylase and alpha glucosidase enzymes that also make use of the wine's other healthy bioactive compounds, end quote. In lay language, what it means is this. You've had Sambuca, you've had non-alcoholic fermented beverages that have been helping diabetics and others turn off inflammation, help digestion, treat probiotics for a long time. Now they're just discovering if you take the alcohol and the processed or added sugars out of a product, it's actually good for you if it's made from natural fruit polyphenols. So why not just do this? Why not encourage people to eat more blackberries and blueberries and raspberries and strawberries? Or take some concentrate, non-sweetened concentrate. Or to take powders, which would give you the greatest benefit because just the greatest concentration of the actual nutrients. So the good news is science is finally catching up, and that's always good. And finally, new research by experts at New York University's School of Medicine and New York University Wagner School of Public Health suggests that exposing babies to antibiotics may predispose them to being overweight in childhood. They studied 10,000 children. They published the results in the International Journal of Obesity, and they found that children who weigh more for their height were those who were exposed to antibiotics from birth to age 5 months of age. Okay, I remember interviewing Dr. Lyndon Smith, in my opinion, one of the finest pediatricians in American history. Wonderful sense of humor, great insights, kind of the quintessential family country doctor. Dr. Smith said that many children growing up before massive immunization never had the problem of inner ear infections. And when they had the more and more vaccines, the more inner ear infections, then to treat the infections, they use antibiotics. The more antibiotics you treat the child with, the more you disrupt their natural bacteria in their gut. The more you do that, then the more overgrowth of candida and the weakened immune system, proliferation of bad bacteria. Then the child grows up weakened. And so by detoxifying the child, the harmful effects of vaccines, which is possible, and then replenishing healthy bacteria like sauerkraut juice or cabbage juice or probiotics, you then recreate a new colony of good bacteria in the child's gut, and they're less likely to have problems with allergies and overweight. That's the latest in health and nutrition. I'm Gary Nall. We have a lot to share with you. And here's a couple things about what happens when we don't pay attention to those people that we elect or put into positions of power and what impact it can have upon us. This is from Mandy Woodruff, businessinsider.com. The feds are cutting Social Security benefits from retirees who cannot pay back student loans. I'll quote this. While most attention in the ongoing student debt crisis narrative has focused on new graduates, it turns out the federal government has been quietly targeting a different group of debtors, retirees. The Treasury Department has been withholding as much as 15% of Social Security benefits for, quote, a rapid growing number of Social Security recipients who have fallen behind on federal student loans. And then it's talking about how many new ones, just recently, it's 115,000 retirees had up to 15% of their Social Security checks taken away because they hadn't paid someone's loan. And generally, it's not their loan. It's someone who they co-sign for. Now, let's look at it this way. How reasonable is this? More often than not, a retiree has been noble throughout their work. They play by the rules. And when it came time to stepping up and helping someone they knew by co-signing on a loan, they did so. And historically, that wouldn't have been a problem. But today, it is a problem. And it's not a problem of our own creation. On the one hand, you have those who have benefited tremendously and economically from the outsourcing of American jobs, corporations that advertise on MSNBC and Fox Network as just two examples, but I could spread that blame across all the newsprint as well. They then have their talking heads, their experts, their think tank representatives on to justify why we need to not raise minimum wage. We need to downsize people. We need to take away their benefits. They're lazy. Are they? Then you're not aware of the American work ethic that I'm exposed to, because everywhere I look, Americans are the hardest working people per population and per capita in the world. No, they're not working the same hours as a woman in Bangladesh or a person in a factory in China, but I'm not talking about someone making 14 cents an hour either. But the way we're going, you'll have Americans working at $3 an hour or $4 an hour if they have their way. So they've outsourced our jobs. And by the way, you know who the biggest culprits are, and no one has even looked in their direction? Equity partnerships. They're the guys who come in and buy a company, load it up with debt, take the debt as their profits, leave the company like Lennon's and things and Circuit City and thousands of other companies to sink, and they've made their money. They don't contribute anything. Bain Capital was one of those. But both the left and right are responsible for that. But then now they're importing jobs of highly skilled, highly qualified people who are willing to work for one-third to one-half of what an American who's actually worked for some time to get in that position, 8 million thus far. And you can pretty much kiss your job goodbye if you're making over $75,000 a year in the United States, because with the new rules on these visas, they can bring in someone from any country. Don't blame the person they're bringing in. They're just trying to make a living. I don't fault them at all. But I do fault our legislators and our corporate culture that puts profits as the only thing that's important to them. So if they have to make a town a ghost town, if they have to make your wage no longer a living wage, if they have to get rid of you and what you've spent 10, 20 years building up in the way of seniority and skills and knowledge to do a job right because you're making too much money or you have too many benefits so they can bring someone in who will be easily exploited without complaining, the media is not touching this. No one's discussing it. So now you have someone that's worked hard their whole life. They're a senior citizen. Has anyone that you know actually gone out to speak with these people? I have. Come with me sometime. Come and see what it's like to sit with hundreds and hundreds of senior citizens who have nothing to look forward to except more pain. You don't see their spokespersons because they have none. And don't even begin to get in my face about AARP because I will lower a brick on my attitude towards them. I'm talking about real, proactive, helping the seniors who are stressed. They are voiceless. They are depressed. They have no advocates, just like the poor have no advocates. Individually, yes. But as a movement, no. So now the government comes in with the banks, always the banks getting their money, and they say, okay, so they got persons making $900 a month. Take 15% of it. You take 15% of a meager income of $900 a month, they're not going to be able to pay their mortgage or rent, food, medicine, and utilities. So which of these are they supposed to live without? We don't care. We don't care. Well, hold on. Aren't bureaucracies or bureaucrats or technocrats or autocrats, whatever you choose to call them, aren't they supposed to have some minor, infinitesimal amount of compassion? Well, they don't. So for those of you who believe the best thing in the world would be to throw massive amounts of money at the next bureaucracy because you've never met a bureaucracy you can't love to support, why don't you actually take a little bit of time and just a modicum of scholarship and go to Washington and just go into any of the bureaucracies and look at their history. What do? They serve our purpose, in which case, how do they serve it? Are they making it a better world for those they're supposed to be serving? How? Have they become our masters? Are you threatened by them? Can they disrupt your life? Can they take away qualities of life? Can they take away your rights, your privileges? Can they spy on you? Can they arrest you? Can they do anything they want to you? And the answer is yes. Well, then why in the world do you want to make even more of them? And why aren't you taking the side of those people that are actually the victims? Or aren't we capable of even looking for victims? As long as you're sitting around the Upper West Side drinking a latte and talking about some kind of ism, then you're not connected with the real world. So someday I'd like for some of you who think you know what's going on to actually go out into the real world, cross the bridge, and go into the rest of America. And then you'll understand, why in the hell do we allow this from this or any administration? My suggestion, throw every one of these low-life bastards out of office. Do not vote for a single incumbent. If you can't have the integrity to vote for someone who's truly populist and truly cares about people, then what do you expect the outcome to be with the people who've done nothing but lie to your face, but do so? And he's got such a nice personality. Look at his tie. His tie matches his shirt. Yeah. And exactly what does that mean? Does that make it a better world for us? So I say this. Let us get people in positions of power who forgive all student loans. Take all the major corporations, all the major banks that are too big to fail, and break them into pieces and no longer subsidize any of it. Not a penny. We have no problem giving corporate welfare. We have a big problem helping people that actually need it and are poor, not because of their own lack of motivation or skill. And Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Laura Ingraham, when was the last time you went out without a camera and without a publicity agenda and actually spent some time in some real middle American homes to see what it's like to deal with their issues, where they won't get a handout, but all your buddies do? And I say the same for the people on the left. Let's forgive all student loans. Let's forgive all debt on those loans and the people holding it, so we can at least save a generation. And why don't we take our minimum wage and increase it to $10 to $12 an hour, so at least when people get a job, their job allows them a chance not to have to work two jobs, which can destroy a family, destroy a person's health, and stop creating massive stress, massive deprivations, just so that the people who are already filthy rich can just be richer. What is the phenomena of us refusing to acknowledge that those people who need more profit above what they have are simply emotionally challenged? They're the ones who need some psychological help, some humanistic value counseling. And we're not willing to take that on. Well, that's unfortunate. Here's the next thing you should know. This is Malternet from Allison Grass from Food and Water Watch. Quote, eminent domain, you know what eminent domain is. That's where the government has the right to condemn or take private land for public use. And it has times been a highly contentious topic because it can displace people from their homes to make way for construction of different projects, like highways or roads or civic buildings and other types of public infrastructure. However, here's what you don't know, and here's what you should know. Now, because of ALEC and because of your corrupt, completely vile state legislators who are willing to sell their soul, and any legislator who has met with ALEC should be voted out of office because they've already been compromised. And ALEC, you should be boycotted. And every one of the corporations that's ever been associated with ALEC should be boycotted because they've sold the vote. Then what good are they? Here's what they've done. They now are allowing eminent domain to private entities, including oil and gas companies. These gas companies are using eminent domain to seize your land, private land, which gives them the benefit of profits and you displacement. According to U.S. Constitution's Fifth Amendment, in order to pursue eminent domain, the land must be taken, quote, for public use, and the private property owners must receive, quote, just compensation. Well, that doesn't happen. Quote, no person shall, deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, traditionally, the public use provision refers to projects that I mentioned, parks. All right? Now, the meaning of public use has been reinterpreted. The controversial Kello versus City of New London law is credited with broadening the interpretation of public use. In this case, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of New London, deciding that the city could take private property and give it to any private entity for its own economic development. So you weren't aware that now, if you have anything that a private corporation finds of value, they can take it away. And then you end up in one of those situations where you don't have any protection. Those are some of our environmental and public health issues. Now for something on a different level. If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Nall. We'll go to my guest right after this. I'm concerning myself with the issue of what do we really learn from history? For many people, nothing. We keep just recycling the same bad policies, ideologies, and dogmas. But my generation has been unique. It's created some wonderful concepts, but it's also created almost everything that's wrong today, including a lost generation, a clueless generation, and a forgotten generation. Hard to imagine in one lifetime we could do so much and then be disconnected and now suffering from our own slings and arrows, our own depression, our own separation from things we once valued and thought we'd have forever, and now we don't. Every generation can be defined by its particular highs and lows. The highs comprise the unique gifts and the Sitzim Leben, one's place in the greater scheme of life, defining a generation's true potential. The lows encompass all the negative conditions inflicted upon a generation by its parents and social and political institutions. It's fascinating to witness the interplay between generations during the course of recent American history. The biblical account of the Exodus from Egypt and the quest for a promised land can be reinterpreted as a myth for every generation. Each generation embarks on an exodus from the captivity of the social paradigm and values controlled by its parents' generation in order to create its own promised land. However, every generation's promised land in turn becomes an Egypt, a land of exile and alienation for the succeeding generation. Now, this cycle of generational sojourns through the social paradigms and expectations of preceding generations has been reenacted over and over, and in every case, a generation's ability to imagine a higher ideal has shaped its destiny. Here we are going to look in this moment, only for about the next 10 minutes, at my baby boomers' promised land and how it's become a land of exile and alienation, full of disappointments, frustration, and anger for our children and their children. The danger I see is that the majority of today's younger generation might be the first in American history whose capacity to envision higher ideals for themselves has been smothered by our generation's neglect to nurture positive values in our homes and communities, and by our replacement of a viable work ethic with a culture of tension between competition and entitlement. Young adults are now struggling to find a meaningful identity, and we should help them in that. When imagination is snuffed out of a society, stasis and depression ensue. Mao Zedong's communist agrarian revolution, which ultimately led to the Cultural Revolution and the atrocities committed by the Red Guard, is an extreme example. Mao and his comrade elites discerned everything in Chinese society as either black and white, perishable, and banned many forms of traditional Chinese culture and entertainment, music and literature and art. All of these activities that we generally associated with the imagination were outlawed and replaced by political display that didn't deviate from the ideal of Mao's socialist vision. Any product of the Western imagination was immediately suspect and regarded as an enemy of the revolution. All personal pursuits, even hobbies, were either sanctioned because they benefited the government's social ideology or branded heretical, punishable by long prison, interments, or even death. For several decades, apart from entertaining their imaginations privately or in dreams, the Chinese population lived in a world empty of imagination and hence any valid spirituality, unable to manifest free expression in their personal lives. Now, during the past decades of the boomers' reign over American society, a very subtle form of subversion of the imagination has occurred. Now, I don't want to suggest that this control of our children's imagination is intentional or even particularly conscious. What is important for us to realize is that the child's world today, defined and orchestrated by our social and corporate institutions, Hollywood, toy manufacturers, computers, games, televisions, entertainment industries, has been primarily defined by grown-ups, and this continues at the expense of children's freedom, their inherent personal gifts, and the power of their imaginations. There's no high ethical standard by which these industries operate other than competing for the population's attention to consume and consume more in order to sustain the illusion of a healthy, growing economy. The result has been the shaping of children's vital imaginations into a hallucination, not of the innocence and free expression of the child, but of the bombardment of seductive images to mold children into loyal consumers of the future. This is not an expression of a healthy and positive imagination that reinforces spiritual values and free thinking during a person's formative years. Following the stage of innocence and preschool exploration of the world, children enter a school system to learn how to become productive members of society. How did the education system fail boomers? In what way is the education system today controlled by this generation failing as children? A critical shortcoming of a large segment of boomers has been their buying into a consumer-based corporatocracy and hence ignoring their generation's higher ideals for social and spiritual transformation. The pursuit of possessions and material comforts to provide a false sense of security has a psychologically numbing effect upon us. Things possess their own kind of gravitational pull when the mind and emotions become identified with them, often stronger than the lofty airiness of spiritual values and altruistic social goals. A fearful life preoccupied with its welfare and security in the future is a life of constant struggle and competition and turmoil. The ancient Greek two-faced goddess, Hecate, also known as Kor, portrays the dual sides of life experience. In the Greek mysteries, she was regarded as an image of the world's soul, the energy behind all that lives and breathes. On the other hand, when our mind is immersed in the density of possessions and consumed but with the pursuit of finding security in relationships and things and inane activities, her face appears wrathful. It indicates that when we turn our attention only towards how we can satisfy our gross physical senses, the world becomes a realm of constant struggle and unnecessary suffering. Alternatively, when we place our attention on higher values, on how we can improve ourselves, manifest our full potential, and benefit the lives of others by social sacrifice, caring about the needs of others, not the least or the poorest, then Hecate's other face appears caring and benevolent. Life then flows effortlessly. For the Greeks, Hecate's face of joy embodies what sages have referred to as the contemplative life, a life with open eyes, the life I refer to as mindful living in this moment. Another instructive image about possession's psychological burden is found in the famous ancient poem, The Hymn of the Pearl. In the early apocryphal text, The Acts of Thomas, which influenced the wonderful German film, I don't know if you saw it, I loved it, called Wings of Desire by Wim Wenders, the poem is an excellent analogy of how we lose our bearings in life when we become overly attached to the accumulation of possessions and forget our spiritual identity and higher values. The hymn is about a king who sends his boy to recover a pearl guarded by a serpent in the sea. And during his sojourn, the boy enters a country renowned for its obsessive pursuit of possessions and its self-indulgence in superficial pleasures, which he had earlier been warned about. The boy is quickly seduced by the citizen's lifestyle, mindless, selfish trivialities, and is lulled into forgetfulness about his true origin as the son of the great king. He becomes simply another citizen, void of unique identity, just another obedient servant of the country's ruler. Eventually, a messenger delivers him a letter from his father. The letter awakens his memory to who he really is, and he continues on his journey to recover the pearl. The story is a compelling portrait of young adults' immersion in boomer culture. The question is, where are the parents who will deliver the letter reminding their children and their grandchildren of their authentic self and the purpose on earth? Boredom prevents us from actualizing our true potential. In fact, it makes us forget we even have one. We might engage ourselves in endless activities and busyness, but this only gives us a superficial feeling that we are not bored. Just like the boy in the hymn who forgot his royal heritage, we inadvertently become servants to whatever the social system tells us. We lose sight of the precious pearl awaiting us, the symbol of our authentic self and true potential, which brings joy and peace and happiness into our lives and by extension what we share with others. Yet we have become conditioned from childhood to be experts in boredom. And our educational system has been the supreme guru in initiating us into a society of mediocrity, empty of spirituality, value, and fulfillment. The serious failures of today's educational system began before the baby boomers and the World War II generation. The origins of the system we have inherited today can be tracked back to America's towering early 20th century industrialists, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, and Henry Ford. In 1924, the ever-insightful social critic and satirist H.L. Mencken wrote that the purpose of public education during his life was not to fill the young of the species with knowledge and awaken their intelligence. Nothing could be further from the truth. The aim is simply to reduce as many individuals as possible to the same safe level, to breed and train a standardized citizenry, to put down dissent, to stop originality. This is the aim in the United States, and that is the aim everywhere else. So said Mr. Mencken. In his excellent expose on the origins of modern education, the underground history of American education, John Taylor Gatto identified three fundamental principles that had defined the best of American education in the past. One, to develop good, caring people. Two, to develop good citizens in the community. And three, to make every student discover their higher, unique purpose and to guide them in developing it to the maximum. These principles, in fact, mirror the aspirations of the nation's founding fathers, such as Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, who envisioned a robust, discerning, and enlightened America. What happened? However, with the advent of the industrialists that I just mentioned and the other founders of the social efficiency movement, Frederick Winslow Taylor, in the 1910s, these principles were replaced with a single goal. The single goal was, since children are seen as a human resource, education's directive became to prepare students to find their place in the industrialized world. This goal was not only the vision of the industrial leaders, but also adapted into American politics in the White House. Gatto documents these words of Woodrow Wilson before he became president. Quote, "We want one class of people to have a liberal education, and we want another class of persons, a very much larger class of necessity in every society, to forego the privileges of a liberal education that fit themselves and to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks," end quote. It is my belief that this perversion of public education's role in producing bored workers and consumers in the future continues today in a modified manner. The difference is that sitting at a machinist bench has been replaced by sitting in a corporate cubicle with a computer. I am Gary Knoll. Those are my thoughts. I will not have time for calls today. I want to go directly to our guest, but this is just a continuation of my own original commentary on how we've gotten to be the mess we are today. Let us understand that we are a product of our history. And if we cannot understand that, then there is no way of stopping it from repeating itself. My guest is now on the line. Let's go over and say hello to her. I had mentioned her earlier background. She is Dr. Lucia Tomjanovic, and she is a postdoctoral fellow. She received her PhD in biochemistry from Comparative Genomics, a center at James Cook University in Australia, and also headed the Neurodynamics Research Group, University of British Columbia, and has worked with a renowned neuroscientist, Professor Christopher Shaw. She's currently researching neurotoxic effects of aluminum vaccine adjuvants. Welcome to our program again.
Oh, hi, Gary.
Let us begin where we left off. Please take all the time you need to explain the idea of herd mentality, that if enough people in a society are vaccinated, then that protects everyone in the society. And if you're not vaccinated, then you are a threat to those who are vaccinated. And tell us what you have found and you have written in a report on this topic, because it is one of the basis of the philosophy and theory of why we should all be vaccinated with so many vaccines. The forum is yours.
Thanks, Gary. Well, it's interesting they say that, high vaccination coverage is needed to for herd immunity. And then that theory of herd immunity, again, assumes that vaccines are actually effective in preventing diseases. And if that were so, then why would an unvaccinated person be a threat to the vaccinated one? Because if vaccines work, then they should be able to protect the vaccinated individual. There is another problem with this assumption, again, which is when one looks at the data, and I'm talking about the scientific data, which shows that there are increasing numbers of reports of actual infectious disease outbreaks, which occurred despite high vaccination coverage. And so that kind of blows off the lid of this whole concept of herd immunity. And I like to quote from the actual report so people don't think I'm just making this stuff up. And most of what I'm going to quote comes from actually CDC's own journal, which is the Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report. And it shows numerous examples of infectious disease outbreaks which occur despite high vaccination coverage. And what I mean by high vaccination coverage is even up to 100%. And so there was a report from 1983, which was documenting a measles outbreak in high school. And, quote, it says that this outbreak demonstrates the transmission of measles can occur within a school population with a documented immunization level of 100%. Then there was another report about the diphtheria outbreak in Russian Federation, where an estimated 90% of children were fully vaccinated with four or more doses of the diphtheria toxoid vaccine. And despite a high vaccination coverage, there was a diphtheria outbreak of epidemic disease proportion. And that was, again, from CDC's own journal. Further, the following two examples are even more interesting. There was one from the journal Vaccine from the 1998, which documented a subclinical measles infection, which actually occurred in individuals who were seropositive. That means basically that even despite high antibody levels, these individuals still contracted the disease, which is a really a case for concern, because the whole theory of vaccination rests on a premise that if you have high enough antibody levels circulating in your body, that you're protected against the disease. Well, if that's the case, then how come even those who are seropositive contract the infection? And this is not an isolated case. There was another report from 1992 where they were examining the reasons for this, what they call a secondary vaccine failure. And basically what they said, that neither prior vaccination nor the secondary immune response, which is basically determined by the level of the antibodies, ensure protective immunity. And I mean, I can just go on quote unquote until tomorrow these examples, but they clearly show that the herd immunity concept doesn't really rest on solid scientific evidence, as some medical authorities would like us to believe. And the next comes the question: why is it that vaccines fail to protect prevent diseases? And so one of the likely reasons is that vaccines primarily stimulate humoral immunity, which is the antibody-based immunity, while they have little or no effect on cellular immunity, which is your cytotoxic T cells. And the cellular immunity is absolutely crucial for protection against viral and bacterial pathogens. So this basically explains why vaccine-induced immunity are basically transient. Vaccines are effective, basically, but only for a short period of time, and that's why they require multiple boosters, unlike naturally acquired immunity, which tends to be permanent. And again, the reason for this is that the vaccines stimulate only production of antibodies. And this is because they bypass the natural route of infection, because you are basically injected with an infectious agent or a foreign antigen directly bypassing the skin barrier and bypassing the gastrointestinal barrier, or which are, you know, your natural routes of infection. So they bypass the cellular immune system, and again, you cannot. The cellular immune system is there for a reason, and it's naive to assume that you can just bypass it and expect that you will get protection against diseases. And there was research in the last year, particularly on pertussis, that slowly is emerging, and it shows some of the reasons for this vaccine failure. Basically what was found is not only is the route of infection a problem, but the nature of or the characteristics of the actual antigen, because most vaccines use some form of modification of an infectious agent. So in the case of pertussis toxin, it's a chemical modification of the toxin. And what the research from just a year ago revealed was that this chemically modified toxin does not induce an adequate immune response, which is necessary for effective protection against pertussis. And this was published in Vaccine, which can hardly be classified as an anti-vaccine journal. So, again, there are just so many cracks in this theory that vaccines are effective. And I'm just always amazed how people simply believe blank statements which are not supported by any shred of data. And it's even more disturbing to find that such statements are made in scientific journals. And one of the most frequently found in scientific reports is that vaccine saved millions of lives. And they never quote a single reference. Like, it's a common knowledge, and no one should doubt it. And I'm like from a Missouri state. I want to see the evidence. And when one looks for the actual evidence, none is found. And again, I'd like to go to CDC or the public health authorities to look for evidence, because I would assume that they would be the one to have the evidence. Often you have something like a table which shows the disease incidence at the beginning of the 20th century, and then disease incidence at the end of the 20th century. And there will be something like 95 to 100% decrease, such as like in diphtheria, smallpox, and polio. And this is actually a table from again, CDC's own journal from 1999. And basically, they said that this proves that vaccines eradicated these diseases. Well, that doesn't prove anything. That only shows that disease incidence decreased. It doesn't prove that the vaccines have been the cause. And then to make matters worse, there is another report from the CDC from the 1999, where they actually admit that the control of infectious diseases has resulted from clear water and improved sanitation. And they go on to say that healthier mothers and babies have resulted from better hygiene and nutrition, availability of antibiotics, greater access to health care, and since 1900s, infant mortality has increased 90% due to these measures. So, if the infant mortality has decreased by 90% due to better hygiene, nutrition, and availability of antibiotics, then where is this all credit that vaccines...
Well, that's the point. Let me mention we're coming up to the end of our regular program. We're going to extend it here a bit. If you want to go to your telephone and continue listening to the program, you can call 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or listen online at progressiveradionetwork.com. My guest in this segment, our newsmaker guest, really doing a wonderfully insightful job of explaining the flaws, the myths of the herd immunity, is Dr. Losia Tomjanovic. And she is a scientist, and she has published in peer-reviewed literature. She is the editor, the associate editor of the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. And to her credit, she has taken on her colleagues. My final comment on this for you, or my final question for you, is this. Historically, we have compared the last 250 years of public health measures from official public health documents. And we have found that when they eliminated child labor abuses, sometimes people forget that a child in the 1800s, early 1900s, would work 12 to 14-hour days for 10 cents a day. And then people would sometimes, especially in the crowded areas of lower Manhattan, live 16 people in a basement with no toilets. And we forget about malnutrition. And many times they were drinking septic water, which lowered life expectancy. When we cleaned up the public health, got people into better living environments, gave them better nutrition, then these diseases began to decline. In point of fact, almost all the major diseases that we gave credit to the vaccines for eradicating were 95 to 99% gone prior to the first vaccine being introduced. How is it that the full body of science has refused to examine these documents and show that it is not the vaccines, but rather the change in public health measures that have increased lifespan and reduced these in killer diseases? Your final thought, please.
I think it's very simple, which is cleaning up water requires the government to invest the money, and it doesn't bring money to pharmaceutical companies. While pushing vaccines does the opposite.
Okay, well, you just answered it. And after all, today, those vaccine makers are members of the pharmaceutical complex, and they control public health policy. We show that, demonstrate that conclusively in the war on health, death by medicine, prescription for disaster, and the drugging of our children. That's just some examples. Thank you for your good work. We really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to having you back on again in the near future to talk about other issues. My guest, Dr. Losia Tomjanovic, T-O-M-L-J-E-N-O-V-I-C. Now, in the final moments of our program here, we have Jeremy on.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeremy. And Jeremy is reading some of the mail. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Gary. So I have a message here from Linda, and Linda says, with the passing of Phyllis Diller a few days ago at 95 years old, Linda's reminded of when she was 18 and used to come down to WMCA a few days a week and on Saturdays when there would be up to 150 volunteers helping you answer your mail. And letters would come in inquiring about guests you brought on your show, different recipes, book titles mentioned on air. And after the program, you would spend 6 to 8 hours answering in writing the mail you had received. And now Linda was very impressed to see that some weeks you'd have upwards of 35,000 letters coming in. And to see the likes of many famous people like Greta Garbo, who would actually be writing handwritten messages to you inquiring about a number of subjects. What also impressed Linda was to see how there at WMCA, you didn't have an office. It was just two chairs at the end of a hallway where you would sit and counsel people. And she wondered how could it be that you had such a huge audience, larger than all the other hosts there put together, yet not even a desk? Especially in light of the fact that hundreds of famous people, there would be Greta Garbo, Myrna Loy, Gloria Swanson, Hedy Lamarr, and Phyllis Diller, they would all come in to see you, and you were just in your early 20s at that point, and you would speak with all of them. You eventually moved on, leaving WMCA for WBAI and to work on other projects. And Linda's wondering if you still do this today.
Okay. It was a wonderful time, by the way. People would get there at 6 in the morning. I was on the air on Saturday for 4 hours, from 10 in the morning till 2. And they would have a group of people upstairs in the conference room that no one used otherwise. And they lined all the mail up, and then there'd be openers. Then there'd be people, like a lot of people want a recipe. So whoever was handling the recipes would photocopy recipes and send them out. Someone might have heard a guest, send the information on that guest out, or a book title or something. But the personal questions, I had general research information. So let's say their question was about arthritis. I would give an arthritis overall lifestyle modification protocol, 2 or 3 pages, plus recommended reading and books and articles. So everyone got an answer. And then there were people, all kinds of famous people, and they'd all say, oh, we got someone here, you know. And then a week later, these people would show up. And I remember when Greta Garbo showed up, sure enough, I didn't have an office. But then again, I've never had an office at BAI. I brought it in $34 million, the largest audience in its history, but not even a chair to sit on. That's all right. But when I finished up, by the way, there's a photograph of this on GaryNall.com. You can actually see there's the program director and myself, and on that table for just that day is about 7,000 letters that came in that day, and you'll see it there. But we did have a very good system. And then people would bring in some meals, and I'd ask someone who owned a restaurant to come up, and then I brought stuff down from my restaurant. So we always had food there because it'd be people coming throughout the day, morning till late at night. But it was a wonderful time. My favorite time on radio was there. I couldn't do it at MCA because there was an inhospitable environment. They didn't want me or the volunteers. You got to understand this. I only serve one purpose for BAI or any Pacifica station. I raise the money. There is no value in me whatsoever on any other level, nor acknowledgement. That's the reality. I'm willing to accept that because I'm there for the audience, and the audience for me. The fact the station benefits from it is fine. So what we do here, as you will see, we have volunteers coming in. We have thousands and thousands and thousands of video we give away. Just the veterans, I think today alone, 700 films are going out just so that the BA National Conference, they'll get these. That's the point of the exercise. But today we don't need to answer the letters because it's all about the Internet. So we can send information, resources, referrals to people and help them that way. Or if people want to share, like on We're on Health, you put it up on Gary and All TV for free, and millions of people go in and then share it with other people. So we don't need, 50 people for a whole day answering letters. It's a different time. But the key is everyone who passes on positive information, who takes a time to watch a video and send it to someone else, they're doing the same identical thing that those very conscientious, wonderful human beings used to come to MCA did. And the reason I was not given an office or a desk at MCA was because the owner of the station, Ellen Strauss, was confused and angry that I stood up to her at a meeting. And after that, I didn't exist. And that was fine, because the audience, through word of mouth only, came and have been there ever since. Remember, positive ideas don't go away. They're shared. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and watching. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.